This is Remarkable. Welcome to Remarkable, a marketing podcast for podcasters who aren't marketers. I'm your host and teacher, Dave Mooring, and I want to know what it takes to stand out, get noticed, and build a committed audience of listeners and fans. I'm on a quest to find out what makes a podcast remarkable, and I invite you to join me each week as I interview other podcasters, experts, and marketers. The Remarkable Podcast is part of the Super Simple Podcast Network. If you'd like additional marketing resources, early access to my free podcast marketing course, and to be notified when I release future episodes, head on over to theremarkablepodcast.com. This is episode number 8. In this episode of Remarkable, I get to have a conversation with a longtime friend of mine who is a narrative designer and video game developer, as well as a best-selling science fiction author. He's had an integral role in the development of video games for Red Storm Entertainment, which is an Ubisoft studio that was co-founded in 1996 by novelist Tom Clancy, and it's known for award-winning games such as Ghost Recon, Rainbow Six, and Far Cry. Outside of work, my guest has written a science fiction trilogy which was published by Angry Robot Books called Legends of the Duskwalker, the first of which is a best-selling novel entitled Three. His fourth book, Outriders, is part of a new series and will be available online in a bookstore near you on May 3rd, 2016. In this episode, we talk a lot about storytelling and how to craft stories that truly connect with your audience. Whether your podcast revolves around stories or interviews, you'll learn the keys to great storytelling, the importance of the three-act structure, and how to bring the art of storytelling into interviews. You'll also learn where most people go wrong when telling stories and specific questions you can ask to get engaging responses from your guests. Finally, we cover tips for building a loyal fan base and following, the number one thing you must do before you can start building an audience, and the keys to creating lifelong fans. I'm very pleased to introduce my good friend. Here's Jay Posey. Jay Posey, welcome to the Remarkable Podcast.
Hey, Dave. Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you on. Thanks for giving me some time today.
You bet.
So I'm looking forward to talking to you a little bit about what you've got going on and learning from your experience. But first, can you tell us a little bit about what you do on a daily basis?
Well, it depends on the day. My day job, I am a narrative designer with Ubisoft studio is Red Storm Entertainment. It's a video game development studio that was started by Tom Clancy. Narrative design is kind of a squishy term in the industry, but I'm basically can mean game designer and writer. So depending on the project and depending on the day, I may be doing sort of typical creative writer tasks, writing storylines, characters, dialogue, that sort of thing. Or I may be doing more typical game design, system design, things like laying out AI plans for how AI would use VO in the game, voiceover in the game, things like that. So it really depends kind of on a day-to-day basis. And then in the evenings and weekends, I'm also an author. So write mostly science fiction, and that takes up most of my time.
Well, I want to go back in time a little bit. Can you remember when you first got interested in writing?
I think probably like most writery types, it was something that I was doing before I realized it was a thing you did. when I was a kid, I used to like to make up stories, and usually I would, I'd write them down on, whatever notebook paper was handy. I do remember I was probably in maybe second or third grade when I discovered my dad's micro cassette recorder that he used to record meetings sometimes. And I wandered off with that and would tell stories into it.
And for those people that listening that have no idea what that is, I'll put a link in the episode's show notes on the website.
You can imagine it's like an MP3 player, except you have physical things you have to deal with. Yeah. So it's like a tape, but very small. Anyway, I think the funny thing about that was I don't ever remember actually going back and listening to any of the stories. So it wasn't really important to me that I wasn't really into the craft at that time. I just enjoyed telling stories. So from that, you know, I think I continued just sort of thinking about writing as kind of a hobby. I enjoyed it, but I didn't really start taking it seriously as like a, oh, this is something people actually could do for a living until I guess I was in my 20s actually. So.
Yeah. Was there a time when you were younger where you thought maybe you wanted to be a writer, but you just didn't think it was a possibility, or did it just not ever even cross your mind?
I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, I definitely, especially like when I was in middle school, I kind of had a comic phase that I really thought it would be cool to write comics. But I, at the time, thought that you had to be able to draw comics to also write them. So I was not great with the visual art style of things. I also, I think it didn't seem like a thing that you could make money doing. And that may have been something that my parents encouraged. Was that, well, it's kind of a fine hobby, but, you know, it's not something that you can, you know, certainly that's not going to sustain you, you know. So we all know starving artist stories, of course. So I kind of toyed with the idea off and on. I actually was a computer science major, or I guess I was a mathematical sciences major with a concentration in computer science. But sometime in my junior year, I toyed with the idea of switching my major to actually the journalism school at UNC with a focus on advertising, because I thought, hey, I could probably write ads. That would be a way I could make money writing. But that conversation didn't really go well with my parents, so I persevered with my computer science degree.
So what did you do after getting that degree?
Probably the worst possible thing, which was I went and got a job doing tech support at a video game company. Which, I mean, it's not the worst possible thing. It's just probably not quite what my parents had in mind with what I would do with a computer science degree. But that was sort of my, I've been into games, video games, pretty much since I saw my first arcade, which, you know, for the kids these days, you used to have to go to places to play video games.
And take a lot of money with you.
And take money, yeah. I had sort of, in college, I started kind of investigating game development in general. And that was sort of a thing that I thought, like, well, that would be sort of a creative outlet, you know, where I could use my CS degree, but also do some creative things. It's sort of a notoriously difficult industry to get into. So my master plan was to get a job in tech support and then kind of see if I could make a lateral move once I got into the company, which that didn't pay off directly, but actually did. The contacts that I made doing that came back around several years later. I left the industry after a little over a year in tech support and then re-entered it about 11 years ago. So the contacts that I made, you know, during that tech support time were valuable when I wanted to try to get back into it.
And what did you do during the hiatus that you took?
Several things. So I forget the order of events, but I went and worked for a startup web developer. And then I worked for University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill Business School in their web development department. Did a lot of like database backend kind of programming type stuff, which was soul sucking for me personally. Just, you know, obviously being very creative minded and doing that was not a great fit. So I then left that job and was a screenwriter for 2 years. And then after screenwriting, actually got back into the games industry. So that was my
anything come out of the screenwriting period?
Well, you know, I did not ever sell any screenplays. I was a reader essentially for a producer who was running kind of a development house out in LA. So, one of the things, I did not move out to Los Angeles. So I'm based in North Carolina and, didn't quite have the fire in my belly enough to want to move out to Los Angeles to pursue the screenwriting dream. And, you know, I was pretty convinced that I was so good that I could write from the East Coast and everyone on the West Coast would want my stuff. I did make a contact with a producer, and so he would basically go out and find scripts that were in development, you know, people had written them, but they hadn't been picked up yet or whatever. And he'd send them to me and get my opinion. That was actually a really valuable time for me, both and just learning story structure, learning kind of the mechanical side of why stories work and why they don't. And, you know, I probably analyzed a couple dozen scripts over that time and just had to break down, like, did the story work at all? If not, how would you fix it? You know, if you fixed it, kind of what's the minimum you could do to fix it? And then what would be the major overhaul? And so it was really a good training ground for me to really do a deep dive on kind of the, you know, as I said, the craft of it, which paid off quite a lot when I started in the games industry, started having the opportunity to do narrative design and writing there.
You said you got back into the gaming industry, and how did you go from that to getting your first novel published through Angry Robot?
It was kind of a parallel process. So screenwriting, as I said, was really helpful for both learning sort of the mechanics of storytelling, and then also being very economical and efficient in writing, especially in dialogue.
Yeah, and for those of us that don't know, what do you mean by economical in writing?
Oh, getting the point across in as few as words possible.
Okay.
So having, you know, part of screenwriting is being able to very quickly establish a scene, you know, so it's a mistake when you're writing a screenplay to try and describe every single detail of, you know, the CD bar where your characters are having this big conversation or whatever. One of my common examples that I use in talking about this is just saying, like, you know, we see the bar, even the bar stools are greasy, you know,
right.
Or even the jukebox is greasy or whatever. That's enough to give you a sense of, like, oh, this is not the nicest. most kept up place. And that's enough for, you know, a screenplay is basically a blueprint. You're not writing a movie. You're writing a plan for someone to go make a movie out of. So they just need enough to set the scene and to know what's going on, you know, and to be able to visualize that for themselves. So that's kind of what I mean. You know, you don't necessarily have the time in a screenplay to explore particularly flowery prose. It's more getting your descriptions across quickly without losing any of the power of the scene that you want. So all that training helped out a lot in game writing. So I came in to Red Storm as a this is going to be a confusing term. The term was a scripter, but it's not actually a writer. It's writing code in games, but it was in the design department. So I got brought in because of my CS degree. And then there was a project that came up that was a little bit behind schedule, and one of the guys needed some help. So I just sort of volunteered and said, hey, I've got, you know, I can take on some extra tasks if you want. And, you know, I've done screenwriting in the past. And he's like, oh, great, here. So they kind of gave me a test run. And they were very pleased with that. A little bit later, probably a couple of years, maybe about 18 months after I started the company, we started on a new project. And they were taking kind of an open call for pitches for the storyline for the game. And I actually didn't think that, you know, I still felt like I was kind of the new guy and fairly junior. So I didn't really think that they were going to care what I wrote. But I just figured, you know, this was good practice for me. I'm a big believer that really no writing is ever wasted. So I was like, you know, I'll just write something and I'll give it to them. And of course, nothing will happen, but it's good practice for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I gave it to them and they liked it so much that they asked me to be part of the core creative team for the project.
Awesome.
So narrative designer is a fairly new term in the industry. Well, I guess it's probably about 10 years old now. So it's maybe not quite that new, but I actually was one of the first to have that title officially in the industry. And I believe I was the first at Ubisoft actually to have that title officially, cool. Which isn't, that's not really a pat on the back for me. It's just, that's kind of how young the title was. And it was like, oh, this seems to describe what you might be doing as a designer and writer. Let's call you that. So I was like, right. Okay, that makes sense. That's kind of how I got started on really on the game writing front. Part of the thing about working, so Ubisoft is, you know, one of the largest publishers of video games in the world. I think they're number three right now. They're kind of the game development equivalent of your Hollywood blockbuster movie. And as you might imagine, your amount of creative control working for them is probably not as great as people might think.
Sure.
So we very often are told, like, here is the game that we want you to make, and we want you to make it about these things. So I discovered that I was getting, I just wasn't feeling quite as creatively free writing that stuff as I had thought that I would be, just because there's so many constraints, so many different things that you have to do to meet your market and all that stuff. It's kind of beyond your control as a writer. So I'd had an idea for a novel for a long time, and I'd kind of been poking at it for a while, probably several years at that point. But I'd never really been able to get past the first few chapters of it, because I just kept going back and rewriting it and going back and rewriting it. And I finally realized, like, oh, what I'm doing right now is I'm trying to write my Lord of the Rings, right? Like, I'm trying to write my my magnum opus right out of the gate. And I just wasn't the quality of writer that I needed to be able to do what I wanted to do. So I picked another idea that I had that I wasn't quite as in love with. It was just kind of, you know, this other, you know, anybody who's creative probably has about 100 times more ideas than they can ever implement. So
right.
I just picked another one. And my only goal for that one was to finish it. So I said, all right, so just to, you know, see what the process is like, and to be able to say, okay, I've written a book now. I know what it takes to write a book. I'm going to use this idea, and I'm going to write it and see what happens. And of course, you know, after I got like two or three chapters into it, I completely fell in love with the book and had almost the same problem that I had with my previous one of not being able to finish it, because I wanted it to be so, you know, this thing that I wasn't sure I could actually write yet, but I did manage to finish it.
How long did it take you?
I think I worked on it for about 2.5 years, maybe 3 years off and on.
Wow. Uh-huh.
But there were significant breaks where, you know, I went 3-4 months without ever touching it. And then
sure.
I'd write a little bit for the week, you know, so it wasn't really diligent. But I had made some contacts, with some other writers just, you know, working in the games industry, actually. When I started doing some research, you know, this was back probably in, 2010, 2011, I guess I started trying to decide if I, you know, at first my thinking was, this is just for me. No one's ever going to read it. So it can be whatever I want it to be. And then as I started getting towards the end of it, I started thinking, well, I wonder if maybe it would be worth, you know, either self-publishing it or just sending it to a publisher and just seeing what happens, you know, now that I've done the work. And ran across one particular publisher that basically when they described what they were looking for. So the book that I wrote, let me take one step back. The first book that I wrote was very much a, no one's ever going to read this, so it can be whatever I want it to be. And what are the things that I like? Oh, I like Westerns, and I like technology, and I like martial arts, and, you know, all these things that don't go together. And so I basically made a world where they all made sense. You know, they could fit together and live happily together. So it was this really weird, very hard to describe science fiction book. You know, it's post-apocalyptic, kind of Western-styled cyberpunk kind of book. And I really had no idea how to describe it to anyone. And when I read, so this was, you know, I found Angry Robot Books. They're a kind of a, what I would call a boutique publisher, I guess. They're based out of the UK, and they're a fairly small operation in terms of staffing. Mm-hmm. But they punch way above their weight. So they distribute with, through, Penguin Random House. So they have, you know, global reach. And when I found them and looked at what they were looking for, it was basically like, we like really weird stuff that you can't describe. So I,
ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, I figured, okay, if these guys don't want this, probably no one will. So I'll use them as my test case. And I actually had met some other writers in the game industry who had also written novels, and one of them had published with Angry Robot. And so I sent him the manuscript for my novel, and he took a look at it and said, yeah, you know, I think this would be something that they'd like to take a look at. So he kind of made a side door introduction for me. And so I sent it to them, and about, I don't know, 9 months later, I had an offer for two books, and was very surprised about that and excited. So that is my grand journey from from one place to the next.
And when did that first book come out?
First book was 2013.
And it was Three was the name of the book?
Right, yes. So confusingly titled. Book one of the trilogy is called Three. Yeah, and it is a trilogy that the third book came out last, what year is it? Yeah, last summer.
Yeah, the summer of 2015, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
How was the experience with the trilogy for you, since it didn't sound like you were anticipating writing a trilogy, but that's kind of what it turned into?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because the first book I wrote to be a standalone novel, but as I was getting to the end of it, I realized, oh, this might actually be the start of something, and it wouldn't just be another book, it would be a trilogy. So it kind of leapt from one book to three books in my mind. When Angry Robot kind of asked me, there's a period you submit, sort of the traditional publishing process, you know, you submit a sample, basically you write a query letter and say, hey, here's what this book is about, here's why I think it's a good fit for your publishing company, and different publishers have different requirements, but Angry Robot asked for like the first five chapters or whatever. So you kind of have this dialogue back and forth. If they like what they see, they might want to see the full thing. And if they like that, then there's some discussion. So they asked me what my plans were for it and if it was a series or standalone. And I just told them that basically, that this book is a standalone. I could easily see it becoming a series, which I kind of lucked into that because that was the truth. But that's also kind of, I think, what publishers want to hear. It's right. Like, if you get this book, you're not committing to a series, but if it's successful, it could be, you know.
That's right.
So that worked out well for me. So obviously, the deal that I, the offer that they came back with was to buy the first book and publish that. And then also they wanted me to write a sequel to it. It was interesting because that, I kind of foolishly thought, I've written one book. This will certainly, now I know how to write books, this will be much easier. And the second book was actually much more difficult than the first book. I didn't know until later when I started making more author friends. And they're all like, oh, yeah, the second book is always the worst. That's always the toughest.
Yeah, why is that?
I think part of it is because you get, you know, you've just had your first taste of success. And now it's like, oh, was that a fluke? Do I actually have another book in me? You know, when you're a debut author, when you're brand new, nobody's heard of you. They have no expectations for you. Once you've got something out there, now it's, you know, you're at risk of disappointing people that maybe liked your stuff the first time around. I think there's just this kind of weird, you know, creative anxiety that comes over you that, you know, and like I think with a lot of endeavors, anything that you start, you kind of start feeling like a fraud in some ways of like, oh no, I'm not really an author, and people are going to find out because I can't finish the second book, you know, which is funny because after I finished the second book, Angry Robot came back and wanted to finish the trilogy with me and also start a new series. So I started the third book and I was like, okay. Surely this will be easier than the second book because the second book was atrocious and it was almost as bad, as difficult, I should say. And that one was just because with the trilogy now I have to, not only do I have to write another book and I have the same struggle as do I actually have a third book in me, but it's also, I've set all this stuff up with two books and now I have to stick the landing. And what if I don't?
Right.
I've dragged people along for 2 years and they've read, you know, some thousand pages of my nonsense. And then I blow it up at the very end. You know, it's like, so
you come all the way down the ski slope, the slalom, and then you just kind of fall across the
exactly.
finish line.
Yeah, pretty much, you know, just face plant into a tree or whatever.
So let's dig into storytelling just a little bit. And you said that you learned a lot reviewing scripts from other people as well as writing a couple of your own. What do you think's the biggest lesson that you learned from the script writing phase?
That's a good question because there was a lot to learn there.
anything stick out?
Yeah, you know, I think it was interesting to see how consistent structure could be and still be interesting. And so, you know, if anybody out there has done any sort of research into screenwriting, especially, or just storytelling in general, there's a lot of discussion about the three act structure. And what you do in your first act, and then, which I'll give you the very brief version.
Sure.
But sort of your first act is where you establish, your main character and what normal life is for that main character. And then you give them some incident that changes their life dramatically and now must be dealt with. That's frequently called the inciting incident. And then act two is sort of this development of where the character is trying to, you know, learn to navigate the sort of this new world that they've been thrust into because of this incident. You see, this is where they tend to get, you know, they get a challenge and they make a change and overcome it. And then they get another challenge and there's a lot of back and forth and character development. And then all that leads to your big third act where there's the climax and you kind of see how the character has grown and changed and you have your ending. And if it's an American movie, probably it ends very happily and everything works out just fine. And if it's not, you know, then there are more options there. But so that's kind of the very, very general flow. And obviously that's almost trivializing it. But to see that you have this sort of framework that you can, it almost seems like it's too rigid. It's like, oh, well, now you're just using this formula. But actually you can... it can be so incredibly flexible and still work so powerfully. That to me, I think was just not only seeing it done well and seeing how it works, but also, you know, a lot of the scripts that I saw were not in great shape all the time. And so seeing like, oh, here's why that structure works because this screenplay is not doing that.
And it's not good.
It's not interesting. Yeah. It's not fun or it's not, you know, it's not, meaningful. So
where do you think people mess up? I mean, what, based on that experience or just from reading other stuff, why do people intentionally veer away from that formula? Or do you think they accidentally veer away from that formula? Any insight as to look out for?
Well, I think, a lot of what I noticed, I think, is that sort of people got caught up in thinking that if things were happening, that meant progress was being made in the story, right?
Kind of like in real life. Like,
yeah, you know, like there's a lot going on screen. Things are blowing up and cars are going around and, you know, whatever. It should be exciting. And it's like, well, it would be exciting if I cared at all about any of these people that are involved. Right. But you've done none of the work to make me care about any of the people. And I think that's one of the major things is if people don't establish some kind of connection between audience and character. You know, sort of one of my examples I reach for this is like some of the most amazing, exciting, and also like terribly heartbreaking stories are available to you every single day. And we call it the news, you know, but for the most part, the stuff that we see on the news is just kind of information, right? Because we don't know the people that were involved. And so you get some of those, you know, newscasters try to kind of humanize the stories to draw you in and be like, oh, you know, they give you some details about the people that were involved. But a lot of the times what happens is I think people get caught up in giving the information and trying to get the information in an exciting way. And then they forget that it's actually the people that we care about. It's the people that matter, right? And so you end up with these like incredibly expensive screenplays, you know, the calling for like, oh, this is going to be the, 65 car crash. That's going to be super exciting.
Right.
You're like, yeah, but I don't even know who the main character is in your screenplay or whatever. So that's a pretty common one, I think.
And let's fast forward just a little bit, you know, back to the trilogy that you wrote. Any big lessons as in the difference between maybe what you learned from the screenwriting phase to the science fiction novel that something that we can take away as a tip or a little bit of insight into what makes a great story?
Well, you know, I think it's always going to come back down to the people. And, you know, for my sort of rambling description of my first book, you know, and this is a thing that I think science fiction especially runs into a lot where people get excited about the ideas and forget to connect them to the people in the world. And so it was interesting to me because, storytelling really can touch any sort of any facet of communication. It's not just, you know, writing fiction work or creative writing, right? We see it in an advertising copy, in podcasts, you know, it really any sort of human creative endeavor can use storytelling. And a lot of it just comes back to humans are social creatures, and we learn most of what we learn through watching the people around us and through their experiences, right?
Right.
So pretty much as far back as we go in history, and probably even farther than that, right, we had oral history long before we had written history. And all of that was just a matter of, you know, the elders of the tribe telling the stories of to their younglings gathered around the fire or whatever, right?
Right.
What was going on. So writing a fiction novel is very different in terms of format from screenwriting, because they're doing different things, right? And you can be more poetic. You can be more, you can take more time with description and building a sense of place and giving, you know, a texture to the world with fiction writing. You can do a lot more sort of internal, you know, you can really get inside a character and see what that character is thinking and feeling and have a much sort of closer attachment. But from a structure standpoint, a lot of the same things work, you know. And again, I think it all comes back to getting attachment between your audience and your characters, and then constantly putting your characters into situations where the stakes are, you know, interesting, right? You as long as your audience is sitting there asking themselves, well, what happens next? What happens next, right?
Yeah,
you're doing your job. And again, that can be whether that is in, you know, a movie, or it's in a book, or it's in an interview, or, you know, I guess even advertising to some degree kind of builds that sense of, you know, hey, if you have this product, imagine what your life would be like, right? Of like, you could do this, and then what comes next? Well, you could do this, right? It's kind of the same sort of idea.
Yeah, one of the commercials that keeps coming to my mind, I guess I'm thinking about the Olympics, but the last Winter Olympics was the parents helping up all their little kids from ice skating, yep, and snowboarding, and they just kept falling down and kept falling down, but the parents were there. So you're emotionally attached, and then at the end, the parents are there when they're winning the gold medals, and
right,
it's this commercial, but you're tied to the emotions of the parents and their kids, yep, growing,
yeah,
up and things like that.
Yeah, and you kind of tear up too. You're like, oh,
yeah,
thanks, Johnny. Mom. You're like, yeah, it's, yeah.
Oh, I want to bring that into podcasting a little bit more specifically now. And one that comes to my mind that I'm a big fan of is Dan Carlin's Hardcore History.
Oh yeah, it's great.
Thinking about the Wrath of the Khans, and mm-hmm, you know, he's able to take this history and bring it down to the people. You know, I'm like, you're engaged with the story of the Khans and Genghis Khan because of who they are and what they're trying to accomplish, and you know what their purpose is and how they're trying to expand and take care of their family. Mm-hmm. Are there any other podcasts that you listen to or that you think of that are focused on storytelling that you think do a good job or worth noticing?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So two that come to mind. One is Script Notes, which is with John August and Craig Mazin. Mm-hmm. And they're both screenwriters out in LA. And they talk about a wide range of topics. Obviously, most of them pertain to screenwriting.
Imagine that.
Yeah, it's crazy. But they, being out in Hollywood, they also give you this glimpse of kind of what the working life is like out there. So they just have some great stories of like, oh, we were working on this thing and, you know, these things happened. And so that's probably kind of an odd example of it, because it's not really a storytelling podcast, but they make good use of it, because they do a great job of drawing you in and making you feel like you're at the coffee table in LA with them, kind of along for the ride, kind of
getting
deal.
Some behind the scenes conversations and things.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You know, so you feel like you've got access to a place you wouldn't normally. And then actually, Tim Ferriss, I think, his show, he does a great job of drawing stories out of his guests. And so I just listened to, episode actually that you recommended to me. I think that was the Cal Fussman.
Yeah, yeah. We were just
interview.
Talking about that briefly. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And, you know, Cal was written for Esquire for, I don't know, forever, pretty much. you know, and has just lived an incredibly interesting life, and has such a gift for storytelling. You know, I think the podcast might be, is it close to 2 hours? I think it's over 2 hours. Is it over 2 hours? And it doesn't seem like it at all, right? Like when I got done listening to it, I was like, oh, is it over already? And I realized, oh, wow, this is really, really a long one. So those two in particular, since you already took hardcore history, I think hardcore history is probably one of my favorite examples because I really did not enjoy history growing up. And that was largely because of the way it's typically taught, I think, which is, here's the information, right?
Yeah, nothing about the people.
Yeah, this gets back to what we were talking about before, about the connection, right? And that's, Dan does such an amazing job of giving you the context of the world. Like, well, this is the state of the world at the time. And these are the major players in this world. And here's why those two things matter, right? And then he takes you through how all these things go together. And he's very skilled at like implying the sort of impending doom, you know, or like he'll tell you about this character and then he'll go over and talk about this character. And then, you know, those two characters are going to meet.
Right.
And you're not sure when, you know, or whatever. And so he does this great job of framing everything in a way that you almost don't realize that you're getting the same information. But then when you're done with it, you have this sort of mental movie that you can play back and be like, oh, you remember when Subutai went and all those knights were arrayed against him, and then he sent out his diplomat and they talked to these other allies and they got those allies to temporarily betray their, you know, whatever, and yeah. You know, like this crazy stuff, right? And like I probably would not remember that if I had read it in a textbook, but just again, his skill at understanding not only what the important information is, but how it matters to the people that are involved in the situation, and then communicating that to the audience, I think is, you know, he's kind of one of the best in the business at that.
Yeah, I would agree. One question, and it might be, you might not have an answer for it, and that's okay. We can move on. But I've been trying to think about how to, for those listeners and those of us that do an interview style podcast, how do you go about making a story arc through the interview? Not just asking the person on the other end to tell a story, but actually making the interview itself somewhat of a story. Do you have any thoughts on maybe tips or ideas about that we can take away from maybe how to structure, maybe in our notes ahead of time or interview questions, any ideas for there?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, I would go back to sort of, I would not use the haphazard 3-act description that I gave you earlier, but there's a lot, I think, to that where, you know, a lot of times when we're interviewing people, it's because they have interesting expertise or they've got some kind of, you know, experience, or they're in a place that we would like to be or whatever it is. But the interesting part is always, how did you end up where you are? And I think to get there, you know, you can kind of go back and say, okay, well, before you were who you are now, you know, what was life like for you kind of before you did all that?
Right.
And then what was the point that made you realize that this was the thing you wanted to do, or this was the kind of person you wanted to become, right? Because usually we'll find there's a moment when a decision gets made, right? Whether it's imposed on us because there was some, you know, tragic accident or, you know, so you can have really dramatic ones like, oh, well, I was rock climbing and my rope broke and I fell and thought I was going to die, and you know that I realized I wasn't living my life right, you know.
Right.
Or it can be really subtle things like you know, I was writing an email one day and I realized that the thing I like to do best is to write emails to people that help them and encourage them, you know, or whatever it is. But there's almost always some point in our lives where we sort of realize like, oh, this is the thing, right? And then if you go from there, you say, okay, well, after you had that decision or you had that moment, what was the first thing that you did? What was the first step that you took? Hmm. And that's always interesting We're not always. It can be. Say always. It can be interesting because frequently when you have that sort of flash of inspiration of like, oh, this is the thing I'm going to do. I got to go do it. Then you are very gung ho about it, but you don't really know what you're doing. So you're probably going to make mistakes.
Yeah. That's a good point.
And part of the reason why that's powerful is because I think we tend to look at people who are, for example, if somebody is not an author, you know, not a published author or hasn't written a book yet, but they've always dreamed about it. They probably think like, wow, this guy's written a trilogy and he's got another book coming out and wow, he's really made it. And I'm, you know, no, I haven't made it. You know, I'm still just doing work. Right. But it's easy to put people up on a pedestal and think like I could never get there. So if you can walk that back to the point of like, oh, well, this was the first thing I did and it was a catastrophe, that really encourages, I think, other people to realize like, oh, no, this is a process. It takes time. People make mistakes and you can come back from mistakes. And I think that's also how you draw out a lot of the lessons learned, right? It's like, well, you know, like for me, when I decided I wanted to take writing seriously, I decided, okay, well, I'm going to write a screenplay. And so let me go get a couple books about writing a screenplay and then I'll do that. And, you know, I did it and was pretty proud of what I produced. And now that's sitting somewhere in a box upstairs that I will not show to anyone, right? Because it's like, oh, that's not really very good at all. But that was an important step, you know, for me to make the decision that that's what I wanted to do and then to give it a try and realize like, wow, this is way harder than I thought it was going to be. And turns out that writing screenplays is not just a winning lottery ticket, you know, because there's a reason that not everybody is a Hollywood screenwriter. But anyway, so I think, you know, you can kind of and you can steal that straight from the classic three-act structure of what was your normal life, what was the moment of change, and then what were the challenges that you faced as you were on your way, and how did you overcome them, and what did you learn along the way, right? Who did you meet? What people helped you? Who were your biggest obstacles or, you know, people who made it difficult for you? Things like that, right? And you can really, I think you can, especially if you do your homework ahead of time, if you're doing an interview-style podcast, you can kind of lead your guest down that path and get their personal story out of it while also getting the sort of nice narrative arc to the whole interview. You can also do, you know, I think part of the key to that too is if you've got a really cool, you know, a guest on the show who everybody thinks has made it and you lead with that, like, I'm talking to so-and-so, who is this awesome person who's done all these things that you wish you had done, you know, or whatever. That kind of, you give people the end point and then you back up from there. And now they know, you know, they know how it ends, but they don't know how you got there. And it's the journey that is the most interesting part, right? So all that can be applied.
Really good tidbits in some of those questions too. I'll include some of the questions that you brought up in the notes so people can go back and, check that they're, you know, if you're listening and you're driving in your car, I'll include some of the questions that you can ask to help get through some of that. Let me jump around a little bit and move over into the aspect of what we all need to actually make money from our endeavors, and that's the audience or the fan base. How have you gone about building your audience and your fans? From the last we spoke, your first book has done well, and I think it's been an Amazon bestseller, tens of thousands of copies sold. How have you gone about connecting with your fans and kind of building that fan base?
You know, it's a long-term investment, right? I think for me, well, the first thing you have to do is you have to produce something, right? that helps to have something.
It's been really hard to build fans of my podcast without actually releasing the podcast.
Yes, it is funny how that works. You can do it, right? Like you can start and maybe have like two or three people who are waiting for it. But I said that half jokingly, but really, I think, you know, producing quality work is an important step, right? That you put something out there that you've put your time into that you feel good about. And on that note, I guess I would call it an honest work. And what I mean by that is just something that's true to you, that you're bringing your personal, you know, your personal mm-hmm. experience and perspective to. And I think that's important because if you're really looking for a genuine connection with an audience, then that's what's going to most quickly connect you with the people who will be your lifelong fans, right? Is If you're trying to guess what the market wants, you're going to be wrong most of the time. If your heart's not really in it, you know, probably by about once you get 20% of the way into producing the thing, you're going to lose steam because it's like, well, I don't even like this thing, and probably no one else is going to either. You know, so I think it's important to focus on something that you feel like you alone could produce, right?
Yeah.
It's like, and that doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be innovative or unique. It just means that you have something personal of value to add, right? And I think that's the first step to connecting to the right kind of audience. And then I think it's sort of a matter of, you know, I'm a big believer in generosity, and that in all of its forms. That can just mean time. That can just mean attention, right? I try really hard to, when I meet someone who's read my work or, you know, interact with somebody on, you know, Twitter or get comments on my blog or emails or whatever, I try to take time to genuinely appreciate that person, right? It was real easy at the beginning because I was not getting a lot. You know, it's like when you get one email a month from someone who's read your book, it's really easy to be like, hey, I really appreciate you taking the time to contact me and, you know, and you know, ask them how they're doing and that sort of thing. And it's gotten to be a little bit more of a challenge just in terms of time as, you know, as my audience has grown, I guess. But that's still the philosophy behind it, right? Is you kind of treat each person as an individual that you care about, and then you just replicate that times, you know, 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 or whatever it is that you've got going on. And, you know, I think for me, I'm uncomfortable self-promoting anyway, and it really does genuinely make me happy if something I have produced is of value to someone else.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So when somebody contacts me and they're like, thank you so much for writing this book, I'm like, man, thank you so much for reading it. That's like, I appreciate your time, you know? And so again, I think just being genuine, I'm really never out to ask more of anyone, you know? So if somebody contacts me about my first book, I don't instantly hit them with like, did you know you can buy my course on writing for, you know, $150 or whatever. Right. You know, and of course, when I have a new book coming out, I do contact people and I let them know like, hey, I've got this thing coming out. If you like my other stuff, you will probably like this or whatever. So of course I do some promotion, but that's maybe 10% of my interaction with people. You know?
Do you have a story from a particular fan or anybody that stood out to you that has been a meaningful connection?
Yeah, you know, it's there are several. Probably the one that has been the most significant to me, I think, was actually an email I got from a 15-year-old kid who he just said he loved my trilogy and that he had never been much of a reader and actually didn't really like books and didn't even like reading, but had just happened to come across 3 in the bookstore. I don't even remember. There was some element of how he had gotten the book. I don't think he was in a bookstore. I think someone had just given it to him, or he may have gotten it from a school library or something. But it was like he wasn't even looking to read, but somehow this got forced on him. And after he read it, he was like, and now I realize how much I've missed from books, and now I want to read everything.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, and so that to me, I mean, that you can't beat that, right? If you are the gateway to the world of reading for someone. And that was really powerful for me. And then, you know, there've been some others that have been kind of humorous to me. Like I got one email from a guy who was just very effusive. He was very kind in his appreciation of my work. And then, at the very end of it, you know, just his email signature. And he was a software architect at NASA. So, you know, there's some things like that where you're like, what? That was kind of crazy. But probably the hooking someone on reading was probably the biggest impact.
Yeah, that's meaningful. That's great. I recently interviewed John Naster from the podcast Hack the Entrepreneur, and he talked about building a fan base by responding and giving out his personal email and just a similar type of never taking anybody for granted. And just, he said to this day, still, no matter how many people download, and I think he's in the hundreds of thousands, but no matter how many, if people email him, he tries to respond. you and I've noticed you online, and obviously you and I are friends and we connect. One of the avenues I've seen that you're able to connect with people is through Twitter. So, and you've actually used it very different than I have in the past, and it seems to be working really well for you. Have you had a Twitter strategy per se, or have you just what's been your I guess method of operation for using Twitter, and how's that helped you?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of an idiot sometimes. You know, I like to just make random comments about things probably no one else is thinking about. You know, when I first got started on Twitter, I didn't really know what to do with it, right? It was kind of like, well, some people are talking about Twitter, and I was hesitant at first because probably like most people, I thought like, why would I want to see what people are eating for breakfast? I don't care, right? You know, and then it took me a little bit to realize like, oh, this is an amazing tool for connecting with people I would never be able to connect with otherwise, right? And so I kind of lurked around for a little while and was using it primarily as a news feed, and then started connecting with some authors and, you know, that sort of thing. And it really, once I realized that like, oh, you know what, I can tweet at people and sometimes they respond, it became a good tool for me to just kind of have very easy sort of casual contact with people that I might, you know, like authors that I might end up at the same convention with at some point, you know, things like that. So it was sort of a very low risk way to establish some early connections with people, which was good for me because I'm an introvert and I would say I'm severely introverted.
So you can just pretend like you're out there at some point.
Yeah, you know, basically it's, you know, again, with the limit on characters, you're not going to get into, you know, a real big conversation. It's not like writing an email to someone, you know, there's just sort of this, definitely when I started on it, there was this kind of sense that Twitter was essentially like your, you know, your local pub, right? Where you could go and sit at your table and kind of watch what was going on. And every now and again, make a comment or, you know, bump into somebody, be like, hey, that was cool. Wasn't
right,
it?
Right.
And I think that was sort of I was not strategic about it at all, but that's probably kind of the closest thing to a philosophy I had about it, right? Which was, I don't mind occasionally making the offhand comment about something that people are talking about. I don't mind mentioning this cool thing that I saw. Then as, you know, when my books came out and things like that, and people started searching for me because they read a book or they'd heard about me or they'd seen me somewhere, it became a really easy avenue for me to connect with readers. You know, for me, it's such a low impact thing. You know, Twitter, I can hop on there for a couple minutes and just check what's going on. So it doesn't have the same sort of mental barrier for me as like sitting down to check email, right? It doesn't feel like a thing I'm committed to doing. It's just kind of a thing I'm glancing at. But then also, you know, that same sort of thing. If somebody takes the time to tweet at me, I try to tweet back at them, you know, and at least, you know, thank them for the time or whatever it is. But I think a lot of people are surprised that, you know, sometimes people will just, I think they're surprised that I take the time, you know, that sometimes people get the impression that I'm a much bigger deal than I actually am.
Right.
You know, and so they're like, Mr. Posey, just read your book. It's so great. Thanks for writing it. You know, and they probably think that that's all it's ever going to be. And then I'm like 2 minutes later, I'm like, oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. You know, or whatever. And they're like, oh, I can't believe it.
He tweeted me. He tweeted me.
Yeah. You know, and then I also use it. I found it is really great for promoting other people. I think I probably do that. I do that far more than I promote anything that I do. And that's not out of some kind of scheme of like, ooh, if I do this, they'll do it for me. It's genuinely like, these are people that I like and whose work I think is good, and I want them to have more visibility. So it's really been a great tool for, you know, raising awareness of things that I'd like other people to know about. So, you know, for example, I work with a group called Hope for the Warriors. They're a veterans care group that specializes in helping post 9/11 military members and their families that I do some work with. And so it's great to be able to, you know, as people come to me about my stuff, then they're also seeing great things like that, you know, which I'm able to kind of promote and bring attention to. So all those things kind of work together for me. And again, I think part of it is, again, the mental barrier of, it's such an easy thing to just hop on and do for just a little bit that it's easy for me to be consistent about it, where a lot of the other things that I probably should be doing in terms of promotion and audience building, I just don't have the mental capacity, the energy to commit to it. Like blogging, I've tried to be diligent about blogging regularly, and just have never really been able to get on that that train. Sure. But
well, are there any bloggers or other authors or sources that you go to for inspiration and writing help? I know you already mentioned the Script Notes podcast, but as far as other authors or bloggers.
Yeah, you know, not consistently. I think I'm kind of far enough along in the sort of craft side of things that a lot of the bloggers I've seen that are about writing, they're not writing to me.
Yeah.
Right? I do check out a few particular author blogs every now and again, but it's typically because I know the author. And Chuck Wendig actually is one. His blog is at terribleminds.com, I think, /blog. And I can only, I have to caution you. I think I'm trying to remember his exact tagline, which I'm not going to quite get right, but it's basically, he says something like, you know, not safe for work, probably not safe for life. Because he is an absolute artist at using profanity. So he has some just shocking turns of phrase. So not for everyone, but he has a pretty hilarious way of talking about things. So he's one that I probably bounce to, you know, more frequently than others. But John Scalzi is another that he's one of the more famous SF writers, science fiction writers. And he's actually been blogging, I think, consistently since like 2005, maybe. It might have even been longer than that, actually. I may have done him some injustice, but he doesn't necessarily... I mean, he does blog about writing in the publishing industry, but that's not all he blogs about. He blogs about whatever he wants to blog about. And I think his blog is actually called Whatever. I think it's whatever.scalzi.com. But
yeah, I'll include that as well. Just a couple more questions here. You mentioned a fourth book, which is not out yet as far as I know. But it's coming up. Tell us a little bit about that book. It's not part of the trilogy, right? It's a whole new franchise, new brand.
That's right. Yep, that's correct. It's a brand new series. It's called Outriders. It will be out May 7th. Or no, sorry, May 3rd. It's a Tuesday. And May 5th in worldwide. May 3rd in the U.S. Right. for whoever. In case
listeners are everywhere.
International audiences. Yes, yeah, right. Yeah. And it is it's a military science fiction. So I kind of was leaning on my Tom Clancy roots there and decided to write a story about a small special operations team that's trying to stop the first interplanetary war. It's about a conflict between Earth and Mars, and we haven't in that world. We basically colonized Mars and got kind of content there and didn't really decide to try and explore too much further out. So it's a very, in terms of things in space, it's pretty, still pretty local neighborhood. But yeah, so that'll be out May 3rd.
Awesome. And how was it for you to go from writing about the post-apocalyptic world here on Earth to an interplanetary situation? Was that an easy transition for you, or was it difficult to kind of change gears?
I foolishly thought it was going to be an easier book to write than it was, because I was like, well, now I'm doing, you know, I've been writing military stuff for a decade, I can do this, right? And it was quite a mind shift, because you know, the Duskwalker series, that's the name of the trilogy, is The Legends of the Duskwalker, and it is a very gritty post-apocalyptic world. It's pretty grim, you know. And I wanted to go the other way, you know. So Legend of the Duskwalker sort of thematically had a lot to do with sort of what happens when technology goes really, really bad. Yeah. Or I should say when the human element sort of neglects to control technology, I guess. And so with Outriders, I kind of wanted to go a different direction with that, of the more aspirational, what can we do if we put our minds to it kind of thing. It was really a more... Now that I'm done with it, now that I'm through the process of writing it, it is a lighter book. It feels a little lighter to me. You know, obviously it's really a military thriller set in space. It's certainly science fiction, but it reads, I think, more like a traditional sort of military fiction kind of book. But So even though there is conflict going on, I think there's a lot in there that is really meant to be kind of inspirational about how awesome things can be.
The possibilities.
If we put our minds to the right thing. So I think the two series are kind of almost opposite sides of the same coin in a way for me. One's kind of exploring the darker side of things and one's the lighter side. It was nice to get out of the, sort of post-apocalyptic wasteland for a little while and think about things that weren't quite so grim.
Yeah. How was it for you? And this is probably one of my last questions in regards to this book specifically. You had mentioned earlier about overcoming imposter syndrome. So now that you're more truer to your military writing style, and you've already mentioned being buddies online or in following people in that space in Twitter, so Special Operations Force.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
How do you get through the imposter syndrome? Are you dealing? Are you still?
Oh,
are you still dealing with it now? Or what is your?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, right? Is it's like I'm getting more I've had enough sort of success now after. So I started screenwriting in 2003, right? So that's what, 13 years now of writing. So I'm finally getting to the point where I think like, oh, you know what? I might have some idea of what I'm doing now in terms of writing. So I've got some confidence there. I was very, very nervous about writing military fiction because, I have not served. I have massive respect for our armed forces and for those who have served. And I was hesitant to even try it for a while because I didn't want to seem like I was trying to trade on something I didn't know about. I didn't feel like I'd earned the privilege.
Sure. Yeah.
And actually, there's a comment that another buddy of mine, Mike Cole, is an author. He has a very interesting background, but he was a civilian, he's a contractor and served in Iraq for a while and then came back and was with NYPD and Coast Guard, and he writes sort of military fantasy. He actually has a book, I think, that just came out called Javelin Rain, which I've heard is excellent. I haven't gotten to read it yet myself, but I was on a panel with him at a convention. He just said, the military experience does not only belong to the military, that belongs to all of us. And that kind of helped, I think, free me up a little bit to realize that this gets into a little bit of a concern that I have with our current society anyway, but in the United States, we don't have professional warriors. We don't have a warrior class. Our military is all volunteer.
Right.
And I think we've kind of gotten dangerously close to having the gap between the military and the civilian world where we think like, oh, those people are fundamentally different than I am.
Right.
Right. They're military people and I am not. And that's not the case at all. Right. These are our neighbors. These are our family members. And they're doing a job. They volunteered to do a job and they've been trained to do a job that they go and they serve and they're very generous to do that for our country. So that I think sort of helped me realize like, I can contribute meaningfully as a civilian to our understanding of that world, right? I haven't served, but I've been very privileged to be around a lot of the people. And again, because of my work in games, Red Storm's always been very concerned about getting things right. And so we bring in advisors, largely from special operations. A lot of them are combat vets who have been very gracious to come in and sit down and talk with us about their experiences. And so I realized that I've had access to people that probably most civilians have not had access to. And I've gotten a glimpse of that world. But being a civilian, I've also got a perspective, an outsider perspective in a way that, I think there's some work I can do there from my side of the equation to help kind of bridge that gap. And it shouldn't be only on the people who are already serving in our military to also do the work to try and bridge that gap back our way, if that makes any sense. I was still very, very nervous about it until I got a buddy of mine. His name is Kevin Maurer, who he wrote No Easy Day, which was the the book about the Bin Laden raid, and he's been writing. He's got a number of books on the military, and he's been embedded with the Green Berets for several weeks, several different times, and has really been kind of gotten to be immersed in that world as a journalist and as a writer. And he was kind enough to read the book for me, and probably gave me the highest praise that he could, which was that he felt like I had nailed the character of the men and women who actually do that job. And that as he was reading it, he kind of forgot that it was a sci-fi book, and it just felt
what a compliment.
Right to him. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and so that made me feel like, okay, you know, after that I felt a lot better. Because I think that was my big concern, right, is that I was very concerned that the men and women who do the job for real were going to feel like I hadn't accurately or honored, you know, like I hadn't honored them properly, you know.
Well, it's been really insightful, and you've shared quite a bit. I guess my last two standard questions are, is if I say the word remarkable, is there a particular podcast that comes to mind as being remarkable to you?
The first one that leaps to mind is one that just recently started, actually. It's called Remarkable with Dave Mooring. I almost get the idea that you did that on purpose. But no, but seriously, you've been doing a killer job, and I've been very impressed with to come out of the gate as strongly as you have, and with the guests that you've had. You've been doing a great job. That probably won't be a surprise to your listeners, but, you know, give you that.
Thanks.
I think I have to go back probably to Tim Ferriss, actually. He's one that I consistently find myself coming back to, both for the quality of guests that he has, but also for his skill at drawing sort of the interesting bits out of them. That I think he does a really great job of not asking the obvious questions. You know, and I think, again, if you haven't listened to any of his stuff, the Cal Fussman interview that he did not too long ago, I think is a great place to start, because Cal himself is a master interviewer. And then to hear Tim interview him about interviewing and how they work together, I think is kind of a master class in how to talk to people. So that would probably be the one that's the one that my mind went to. So
yeah, I would agree. That's a great reference. And my last question is, where can people go to keep up with you, learn more about you, connect with you online?
You can find me at jayposey.com. That's jayposey.com. And of course, on Twitter. It's probably the place you'll find me the most is it's at HiJayPosey. That's HiJayPosey.
And if you're listening to this and it's before May 3rd, go ahead and pre-order a copy of Jay's book, Outriders. And if it's after that, head on over and get that copy, as well as any of the first three. You won't be disappointed at all.
Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I mean it. Well, Jay, this has been great. I've enjoyed chatting with you, and look forward to keeping the conversation going. But thanks for your time, and thanks for coming on the Remarkable Podcast.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thanks for having me, and I hope your people all got something out of it.
I'm sure they did. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, man.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Remarkable, part of the Super Simple Podcast Network. As Jay mentioned in the interview, his new book, Outriders, will hit stores on May 3rd. Please do me a favor and help support Jay and his work by pre-ordering a copy today. And as a bonus, if you pre-order a copy in any format, email me your receipt, and on May 3rd, I'll do a drawing and select one person to receive an autographed copy of his best-selling book, 3. As always, I appreciate you tuning in. I know you have a lot of podcasts to choose from, so thanks for joining me and taking time to listen today. You can find my notes, relevant links, and a full transcript at supersimple.com/J. That's supersimple.com/JAY. If you've enjoyed this episode or previous episodes of Remarkable, please do me a favor and share it with someone you know that would also enjoy it. And if you have a question about marketing, a suggestion or feedback, or if you'd simply like to connect, just email me at dave@supersimple.com. I'd love to hear from you and connect. This episode of Remarkable is sponsored by Super Simple University, the marketing education, training, and community you need to build the business you want with the time and resources you have. If you're tired of having to constantly search for answers to your complex marketing questions, if you're fed up with marketing hacks that make you feel uncomfortable or even sleazy, or if you just feel like all the marketing help available these days is just too complex and too hard to grasp, then I encourage you to check out Super Simple You. It's the marketing help you need, when you need it, at a pace that works for you. Visit supersimple.com/university to learn more. Our theme music was composed by Julio Gonzalez at Zymer. Zymer, or Remix spelled backwards, offers sound design and audio post-production for podcasts, video, audiobooks, game apps, and radio. Learn more or contact them today at Zymer.co. That's Zymer.co. Mention that you heard them here on the Remarkable Podcast and save 50% off of any of their services. And if you would like additional marketing resources, early access to my free podcast marketing course designed to help you grow your audience and reach more listeners, and to be notified when I release future episodes, head on over to theremarkablepodcast.com. That's it. Thanks again for listening to this episode of Remarkable.